From the studios of KPCW in Park City, it's This Green Earth, a weekly talk show about the environment and our relationships with it. I'm Chris Cherniak.
And I'm Claire Wiley. Arctic sea ice reached its maximum extent for the year back around mid-March, and according to scientists at the National Snow and Ice Data Center at the University of Colorado Boulder.
That's right. The 2024 maximum is the 14th lowest in the 46-year satellite record. While this year's maximum extent was not among the lowest on record, the long-term decrease in ice extent continues, so says NSIDC senior research scientist Walt Meyer. We'll learn more about this condition and where Arctic sea ice stands now that we are 10 weeks into the melting season when we speak with Walt in the first part of the show.
And then we're going to replay one of our favorite broadcasts. Author and CBS News national correspondent Jonathan Vigliotti comes on to discuss his new book, Before It's Gone, Stories from the Front Lines of Climate Change in Small Town America.
Discussion of the climate crisis has always suffered from a problem of abstraction. Data points and warnings of an overheated future struggle to break through the noise of everyday life. Vigliotti has seen that crisis unfold for himself, spending nearly two decades reporting across the U.S., documenting the people, communities, landmarks, and traditions we've already surrendered. He shares with urgency and personal touch the story of an America on the brink. That's in the second part of the show. Environmental awareness and education, that's what This Green Earth is all about. Stay with us. Welcome to This Green Earth, a weekly talk show about our relationships with and impacts upon the environment. I'm Chris Cherniak.
And I'm Claire Wiley.
And joining us for the first part of the show is Walt Meyer, senior research scientist at the National Snow and Ice Data Center, located at the University of Colorado in Boulder, Colorado. Walt, as always, thank you so much for joining us this morning on This Green Earth.
All right, thanks for having me.
All right, well, let's start with our extent, our maximum extent of sea ice up in the Arctic that occurred somewhere around mid-March.
I think it was March 16th, if I remember right. I can't remember exactly the date right now, but that's pretty much a normal time of period of year. It's usually sometime in March, and it was the 14th lowest maximum, which doesn't seem too extreme, but you know, we've got now 46 years of data, and it's, you know, 14th lowest, and really the years in the last 15 to 20 years have all been very low. So it's not as extreme as what we've seen in some of the years, but it's far different than what we used to see in like the early part of our record in the 1980s.
How different would you say?
Well, it's substantially lower in terms of the area of extent. The bigger change really, which we don't see in our area coverage numbers, but we can see it in other data, is the thickness. And the ice is much thinner than it used to be. It's probably about 50% thinner based on the data that we have. So in March, the ice is extended far out. It goes into the Bering Sea, up the coast of Alaska, all the way down along the coast of Canada, down to the St. Lawrence Seaway, goes all the way down to the northern coast of Japan. So it's spread out quite a bit. But all that ice is pretty thin, and when it melts back in the summer, that's where we get into the thicker ice and how much can survive through the summer.
So the extent is getting less, and the maximum extent, we'll focus on this, is getting less and less, let's say decade over decade. It's also, the ice is thinner, as you suggest, but yet the maximum extent still occurs around the same time of year. It's not occurring earlier, decade over decade?
Not really. There's not much trend in the maximum date and when it occurs. It's very noisy. It's very variable. And that, when you think about it, it makes sense because it's the ice at the very far southern edge that's really defining when you hit your maximum. You know, when it starts to melt versus when it stops, you know, stops growing and or is continuing to grow. And it, you know, it's spread out around the, you know, from Japan over to Canada to Alaska. So there's a lot of areas it can vary, and it really comes down to the weather. Depending on which way the winds are blowing at a given time and what the temperatures are, the ocean temperatures, the air temperatures, as to when it kind of transitions from that continuing to grow out versus now starting to contract. And so, you know, there is a general warming trend, obviously, global warming, and it's affecting the Arctic. So that's why you've got this trend in less extent, lower coverage, area coverage. But the timing of when that maximum happens is still dependent largely on the weather near where the ice edge is.
So let's get back into how climate is affecting this, but I want to maybe have you step us back a little bit and tell us how you collect this data and how over the years the technology has maybe changed or shifted.
Yeah, our primary way of tracking the ice is with what we call passive microwave satellite sensors. They're detecting emission in the microwave range. So it's not something we see with our eyes. You know, we see in the visible range. This is much longer wavelengths. But the nice thing about passive microwave, about microwave emission from the surface, is that it's very different between ice and water. So we can really see the contrast between whether it's frozen or whether it's liquid. Also, you know, clouds obscure our view of the ice, and nighttime obscures our view of the ice. We can't see in the dark with visible imagery, which is 6 months out of the year. Whereas microwaves that are emitted from the ice and the ocean, those don't rely on sunlight. So we see things in the dark, and we can see things through clouds. The clouds don't emit much either. So we get a complete picture of the ice cover every day. And we started, this started back in the late 70s, late 1978. So now we've got over 46 years of that, and it's continuous. The sensors have gotten a little better over time, but the baseline that we have is this continuous record. More recently, we've gotten satellites that can measure the elevation of the surface, which means we can estimate the thickness of the ice. And that's what I talked about earlier, is that we're seeing that it's much thinner than it used to be, thanks to the newer technology that we can get better estimates of that.
So 2023 on a global scale was the quote unquote the warmest year on record for the planet, and that goes back, you know, well over 100-150 years now. And here we are in the throes, still in the throes of an El Nino conditions climatologically, although that seems to be phasing out. It's interesting that given those situations, and 2023 was warmer than 2022, which was the warmest year, and 2021, which I believe was the warmest year, et cetera. But yet, Arctic sea ice still, we would have thought that maybe Arctic sea ice would also have its lowest extent. Is there, what is the relationship between the two? Is it more a function of atmospheric conditions or water temperatures?
It's a little bit of both. You know, one of the things when we talk, you know, you talk about global temperatures, and El Nino is a big part of that, but that's more equatorial.
Yeah.
In the Arctic, it actually wasn't a super warm year. I mean, it's been warmer overall, and the Arctic actually is warming about 2 to 3 times as fast on average. But on a year-to-year basis, it's not necessarily always the most extreme. And so it's been a little bit more moderate. It's still warm, but not like record warmth like we see globally. So that's one of the reasons. The other thing is that no matter how warm it gets, you still have to melt through the ice. I mean, obviously, if it's warmer, it's going to melt faster. But the ice cover is... you know, in the far north, it's not getting a lot of sunlight. And sunlight, the solar energy is a big factor as well. How much gets absorbed, like by the ice versus the ocean? The ocean absorbs much more. So in some sense, that's more important than the temperature as far as the melting of the ice. Also, the ice that's remaining at the end of summer is the thicker ice. That's like 10 to 15 feet thick, maybe. There's not near as much as there used to be left, but what's left there is harder to get rid of. We've seen nothing like a recovery. We've seen a lot of very low years over the last 15 years or so, record or near record low. We haven't gotten to the point, there's not enough energy in the system to really start eating away at that last kind of chunk of the thicker ice, like near the North Pole, north of Greenland, that gets very little energy. It's still cold and it's still thick ice.
We're speaking with Walt Meyer. He's a senior research scientist with the National Snow and Ice Data Center out of the University of Colorado at Boulder. And we're talking about Arctic sea ice, conditions there. And I know for you fans of the Antarctica, we will get to that in the remaining few minutes, but we like to focus on the Arctic since it actually has an influence, obviously, on our weather and climate conditions here, down here. So maximum extent was mid-March, as predicted. Now we're about 10 weeks removed from that. How are things going?
So far, it's kind of following along the same, it's at about the same level relatively. It's about 15th lowest at this time of year. We're kind of in a bit of a quiet period. The ice kind of starts melting back. The thinner ice that melts away every year is melting away. We're just getting to where, into the central, to the Arctic Ocean, to where the thicker ice is and where really the action is during the summer. And that really starts in June through July, right when you have the 24 hours of daylight. So we're kind of on the cusp of where things get, so to speak, exciting, and where the weather and the temperatures and how much sunlight there is really plays a big role. Like right now we're below 2012 levels, which was the record low minimum. And yet, 2012 really sped up in June and July. And so that's what did it for 2012. Are we going to have the same thing happen this year? It's too soon to say. The one thing we see that's quite extreme right at the moment is Hudson Bay is opening up big time right now. The earliest we've ever seen, especially the eastern side of Hudson Bay opening up. So that's not a great indication of what things might happen this summer. It's kind of foreboding, although that could be more of a local regional weather effect, limited to the Hudson Bay. We've definitely seen warm temperatures and strong winds there helping to open things up.
And we'll probably see the minimum extent of ice somewhere around mid-September. On average, how much sea ice is lost between mid-March and mid-September? Maybe either, in square miles or better, maybe in percentage?
So in square miles, it's around 10 million square kilometers. So that's about a little more than 3 million square miles. And it's about two-thirds of the ice cover now. Wow. It used to be about half, but we're losing a lot more ice during the summer melt season. So we're definitely seeing an increase. There's a decline in the maximum, but that decline is smaller than the decline in the minimum in September. So we're losing a greater percentage of the ice cover than we used to.
Okay. So, we talk about the potential chemical and more importantly, biological impacts of less sea ice, more open water. It's interesting that the website, I don't know if I ever saw this one before, it's tracking algal blooms. And so there is an algal bloom season in the Arctic, maybe outside your range of expertise, but can you talk a little bit about that?
Sure, yeah. I mean, this is not something I studied specifically. One of my colleagues was an author on a paper that we highlighted as a kind of a secondary author. But when the ice goes away, there's a lot of nutrients there. And when you have sunlight, you have 24 hours of sunlight during the summertime. So the Arctic is a pretty productive area during the summer. But what we're seeing is with less ice cover, it's becoming even more productive, more algae. And even under the ice, which is something that didn't seem to happen, or at least we didn't detect it, But because the ice is thinner and there's so much energy coming in that you can actually get light through the thinner ice and have algae blooms under the ice cover, they're happening earlier, more widespread, sometimes even twice during the summer. There's enough nutrients and enough solar energy to facilitate two what we call blooms of algae. So there, you know, when you lose ice, there's certainly a lot of negative effects, but there are some winners, especially biologically, mm-hmm. Where new habitats open up.
Yeah, that's where I'm kind of leading towards. The presence of algae can benefit the food chain downstream, so to speak, because algae is phytoplankton. That's a food source for a small fish or other marine life, which then can attract larger fish, et cetera. So there could be some benefits, I'll put, you know, quotes around that, with respect to a larger algal bloom. But there's also consequences associated with it, too.
Yeah, from a biological standpoint, with more open water and more algae, there's more food. And like you said, the food chain, but it favors animals that like open water, that prefer to have, don't like ice to be around. So things like whales and so forth that typically did not inhabit the Arctic Ocean are starting to be seen in those areas in the summertime. Whereas other animals like seals and polar bears and walrus that they like the nutrients and that's great for them, but they need the ice cover because they're mammals. They need to come out of the water and breathe, and they need a place to birth pups or hunt. And they use the ice cover for that as a platform for them. And as that disappears, even though there may be more food, they're not as able to access that because the habitat that they're adapted to is starting to disappear.
Right. So it, most importantly, it changes things, and that can have a ripple effect too. And of course, when algae dies, it consumes oxygen, which then creates a separate set of conditions there in the water column. So for those people who think like, oh well, I'll just have, we got an increase in blooms of algae, and of course, algae takes up carbon dioxide, and hey, everything's going to be. It's going to help. Well, there's like you say, there's pros and cons to this condition. You prefer, I bet scientists would prefer that we not have large algal blooms in the Arctic to begin with.
Yeah, I mean, it's an indication that the environment is changing substantially. Yeah. And like I said, there's the negative changes are bigger than the positive changes for most people, and particularly for humans. So, that's not really a good sign terms of the Arctic.
All right, so I'm looking ahead, if you can, read your tea leaves. What is the rest of May and, say, June look like? Any sense of weather conditions up there?
We haven't seen anything specific yet. I mean, we can't really predict the weather more than, just a week to 10 days out.
Right.
We've had in past years some strong storms come through, and that helps break up the ice. The ice is more susceptible to that because it's thinner, mm-hmm. and it is already more broken up. And so that can facilitate fast melting. That was one of the things that contributed to the 2012 record low. But it's really hard to tell. We're kind of, we're starting to open the door on the summer, but we haven't opened it enough yet to get a sense of how things are looking. It's really kind of more, especially end of June, early July, right when you've got the peak solar energy input, June 24th on the, or 21st on the solstice. That's when we kind of start to see, some years it just doesn't catch on and it doesn't melt as fast. Other years it really kicks in the gear and really goes. So I can confidently say this is going to be a very low year. It's going to be much lower than it was in the 1980s. We haven't seen anything close to the 1980s in several years. The last 16 years, starting in 2007, are the lowest 16 in the record. And I feel quite confident that this will be 17. It will be among the 17 lowest. But where it falls in that is still kind of hard to say. It's thin ice, it's susceptible to melt, but it just depends a lot on the weather, exactly how low it goes.
All right, and the last minute or so, tell us a little bit about what's going on down in Antarctica. It's obviously fall there and it's heading into winter, so sea ice is returning. Any news of interest there?
Well, yeah. So it is growing, and it grows back pretty fast in the autumn and through the winter. But it's, last year we saw just a stunning slow growth, and we reached a very low record maximum. It just did not grow out like it normally did. Just a huge difference. This year is looking not as extreme. It's a little bit of a reversion to the mean, but it's still quite low. So it's going to be interesting to see what happens there in this next few months as we get to the maximum Antarctic in the winter, which is in September as well. So we'll be watching that closely as well.
All right. Walt Meyer, Senior Research Scientist with the National Snow and Ice Data Center out of Boulder, Colorado. Walt, as always, website, it's nsidc.org or .gov?
It's nsidc.org.
Oh, yeah.
And then for our sea ice, it's just add on a / Arctic sea ice news, all lowercase, all together, or you'll find it from the main page as well.
All right, Walt, thanks as always for joining us. We'll speak to you in September.
All right, thank you. Always
thanks,
nice talking to you. Thanks.
All right, let's take a break for a couple of underwriters. And when we come back, we're going to have a little encore performance from one of our former guests, Jonathan Vigliotti, about his book, Before It's Gone, Stories from the Front Lines of Climate Change in Small Town America. It's This Green Earth. We'll be right back.
And you are listening to This Green Earth. I'm Claire Wiley.
And I'm Chris Cherniak.
And our next guest is CBS National News correspondent Jonathan Vigliotti, who has just released a new book called Before It's Gone, Stories from the Front Lines of Climate Change in Small Town America. Welcome, Jonathan.
Thank you for having me.
Absolutely. We are excited to have you and get into this book. But first, I want you to share a little bit about your background and how you got started in journalism and specifically covering climate.
I have always loved nature and wildlife. My journey for me began as a kid growing up in the 90s on the East Coast in a town called Mount Kisco in New York State. Mm. And back then, if you were to visit the blue house with the red door on Meadowbrook Lane and ask my parents where I was, they would most likely tell you I was in the nearby woods playing. I was a Boy Scout. I loved retreating to those woods. I would write, draw. I did everything as a kid growing up there. And it was around the same time I learned how fragile our ecosystem is because a housing development was proposed in those very woods. And that was also the time that I learned the power of the word, in this case, written words, because my parents, along with everyone in the community, came together to write leaders in protest of this development. They were specifically concerned about the nearby wetlands and the impact the development would have on nesting birds. And ultimately, I would like to think those letters mattered, that this community activated as one mattered, because that development was scrapped. And today, when I go back to the same home on Meadowbrook Lane, I also return to those woods, which are still there today. And I continue to daydream whenever I go there. And that really launched me on this mission, first through photography, and then through radio and reporting, and eventually television news and using video as another element to tell stories initially of our environmental crossroads, similar to what happened in my backyard. I went to Fordham University in the Bronx, and then from there, I launched to my first job in Grand Junction, Colorado, and pinballed across the country as a rookie reporter to Milwaukee, Miami, then New York before joining CBS News as a foreign correspondent initially in 2015. I was based out of the London Bureau and then made my way because of my coverage of a wildfire when I was assisting when there was a staff shortage to the West Coast Bureau. I moved here in 2019, where I really started to ramp up specifically my coverage of extreme weather events and climate change responsible for fueling them all.
And you've written a lot about natural disasters, a lot about the aftermath of what happens. And now in this book, you're concentrating on mostly small towns. And I'd like for you to talk about that, but also in the book, instead of just the aftermath, you're covering the possible maybe predictions or in some cases, lack of preparation that could also work into these disasters.
That's correct. And it oftentimes comes from people not imagining or understanding climate change and its impact on our weather. I've always believed that journalism, specifically storytelling, is a powerful tool to help people understand how our world works. And I've been given unique access as a journalist who has, for the past 5 years or so, specifically for CBS, traveled across the country covering every kind of weather disaster, oftentimes they're called historic disasters, and I've covered countless historic disasters. It was my hope through this book that I could bring viewers and readers along to these front lines so that they as well could visualize through my words the impacts and understand the impact climate change is having on all of this, not just radicalizing our weather, but then that radicalized weather and its impact on our small towns. I focus specifically on small towns, first and foremost, because that's where I oftentimes found myself reporting on these stories. But all of these small towns are connected because they lack infrastructure, engineering, and the kinds of budgets that bigger cities have. So when a big storm does hit one of these communities, they're easily erased from the map. Over the past 5 years or so, I've covered more than a handful of communities that have been destroyed by fire, by hurricane, by tornado. And all of these small towns, I believe, are like canaries in the coal mine for bigger cities, because Mother Nature is beginning to outpace our ability and all of man's modern tools to hold her back. And more what we're seeing in these smaller communities, which is easy to forget as the media attention moves on, is going to start to impact bigger cities. I've seen this and reported on this firsthand with Superstorm Sandy in 2012 in New York City. And there's going to be more storms like this. And we've seen this countless times in bigger cities, but they oftentimes rebound quickly. What happens, though, when we start to lose our grip, which we are beginning to lose our grip? Going back to New York City briefly, just in 2021, there was a spike in sinkholes, 31%, a 31% spike. And the community came together and local organizers, and they said, you can throw as much money as you want at this issue. We're running out of engineering solutions to prevent more sinkholes from happening. So what happens when that begins, kind of this new reality we have? And what can we do now to protect ourselves, to develop new engineering solutions, to build more resilient communities? It's one of the main questions in the book. And I hope the takeaway is we are all individually and as individual communities empowered to take action.
Well, the book is broken into four parts. There's fire, there's water, air and earth. You kind of touched on briefly fire, you know, with the classic iconic examples being, say, Paradise, California, Lahaina now, and
yeah,
just
Lahaina.
This past year of communities just, well, you know, wiped out effectively. And now trying to, in Lahaina's case, they're still, you know, trying to assess the extent of damage.
Yeah.
They haven't even begun to rebuild. They're just trying to, at this point, clean up from the videos I periodically see. But those are classic examples of system, weather systems and perhaps climate influencing, in this case, wildfire systems. Have you had other examples that you wrote about or covered?
Yes, and in each element, there are examples of this. And I'll touch on Lahaina in a second, but most notably in the air section, I focus on the impact of tornadoes on more eastern states. You know, traditional Tornado Alley was traditionally west of Mississippi, but research has shown that our warming atmosphere is pushing the traditional Tornado Alley further east into areas that researchers call Tornado Fatality Alley because of the higher number of people living in these communities. And so what you're seeing are more severe storms, supercell systems, which birth not just one, but many tornadoes. And in 2021, the winter of 2021, we saw the impact of one such system, which meteorologists called the Beast, a mile-wide tornado that traveled on the ground for more than 100 miles and destroyed Dawson Springs and Mayfield in Kentucky. And these were communities that were not prepared and did not truly understand the threat. They have had tornadoes in the past, nothing quite like this. And little did anyone really know at the time the impact that the weather was having on making these events perhaps more likely. One of the main sentences that I wrote in my journal before I began this book, which became kind of the theme of my book before it's gone, is before every disaster, there is usually a scientist that has been ignored. And time again, while covering these stories, I've seen that happen. Mm. Lahaina is unfortunately a perfect example. My team and I were one of the first network crews to arrive in what was left of downtown Lahaina. Mm-hmm. 80% of the area was destroyed. More than 100 people were killed. No one received evacuation orders. We arrived to what looked like, and as I described in my book, an environmental holocaust. Mm. And what we learn later in the days and weeks that followed, as local leaders describe this as an explosion, it was like a bomb going off, implying that there was no time to take action. Scientists actually, nearly a decade before this fire, came out with a report on the island saying that the island was vulnerable to fire because of climate change. And they even offered solutions for what the community could do to prevent this risk, including restoring wetlands, conserving water, which had been depleted because of the growing population and the tourism industry, removing dry invasive grasses, which had taken root because of where people had grown, and also building and updating homes with fire-resistant materials, which qualified for tax credits and would have lowered insurance bills. But this plan was essentially filed away, and nothing was done in time. And so those warnings, unheeded, became a self-fulfilling prophecy. And this is a common theme in towns across the country. And one of the questions I asked when I was there on the ground reporting, as I walked along historic Front Street, miles of it destroyed, there was one home still standing, unscathed, right. The house with the red roof, as locals there now know it. And this was a home whose residents had updated the building and implemented those scientific remedies before this fire. They removed grasses and bushes and trees that were too close to the home. They put river stones around the foundation of the home to prevent a fire from reaching the foundation of that property as it did that day. And they also put a red metal roof on top of the house. And across the country, in storms by other names, many of those storms covered in my book, there are examples of homes with the red roof. And they all, the homeowners of these homes, share one thing in common. They listened, they were sensitive to the information, even when local leaders necessarily weren't, and they were empowered to take action. And my hope is that more people realize, as individuals, we have the power to take action, to identify risks in our own community, to listen to the experts in our community who are helping identify those risks. And then when understanding them, we can take action. We don't need to be paralyzed by the science that tells us we're threatened. There are oftentimes solutions, right. But those solutions only matter if we listen, understand, and then act on it.
Well, and having lived for years in Florida, I see examples of that too with respect to homes that have been hardened years and years and years ago, who kind of took heed back then of the growing intensity and frequency of hurricanes and tropical systems, and now are there's the ones that are making it through the storm, or at least not beat up as bad as those that don't take heed. So examples of that, you know, like you say, with respect to fire, with respect to hurricanes, and perhaps with respect to tornadoes and hardening homes, yeah, and building more storm shelters. Let me reintroduce you real quick. If you're just joining us, we're speaking with Jonathan Vigliotti. He's a CBS News national correspondent and author of the new book, Before It's Gone: Stories from the Front Lines of Climate Change in Small Town America. Now, Jonathan, you talk about, you know, fire that can wipe out a community, but that community can come back in one form or another. Mm-hmm. Tornadoes that have wiped out communities, and those communities return, rebuild, per se. But there are other examples where perhaps rebuilding is not an option. And I always think about the coastal communities where sea level rise and water table rise is slowly eating away at at the both from, you know, lessening the landmass and also kind of sinking the landmass at the same time. And I always think about the Florida Keys or the Outer Banks of North Carolina, perhaps certain areas of the New England coast. Do you have some examples of those situations like that?
Yeah, you mentioned the Florida Keys. A study was done by Monroe County where the Florida Keys exist. Yeah. And they looked at specifically a 3-mile stretch of roadway impacting access to one of the communities on the Keys. And they wanted to see how much money it would cost to elevate just 3 miles of road, 1 foot. And they found it would cost $75 million and only guarantee dry roadway through 2030. Hmm. And that was not a financially feasible option for this community. Right now, the discussion is, do we have ferries? Do we offer boat transportation to these homes for when this road does get flooded out and the water doesn't recede? In Fairbluff, North Carolina, you had this community of about 1,000 people that was first hit in 2016 by Hurricane Matthew, followed by Florence 2 years later. And it wiped out 39 of 40 businesses that were in town. There's only one business that's currently active. Half of the population left. Hmm. The town is now struggling with how to rebuild. They've lost so much of their tax base. They're looking to rebuild downtown to a place called Uptown on a higher elevation, but they only have about 50% of their population. They're struggling with taxes to make this all possible, and they're trying to get money from the federal government to help them rebuild. But more and more in places that are not sustainable to live, that are too dangerous, we're seeing the federal government come in and do what is considered and called, and it's quite controversial, managed retreat. Mm. It's a buyout program where they're assisting people who do want to move. And this is not an option that people in wildfire country have. It's being researched to see if it's feasible. FEMA is doing this research. But as of now, there's about $700 million that FEMA has to buy back homes from homeowners that are in areas that are simply unsafe to rebuild. But I do think that there is a growing focus on finding safe ways to rebuild communities that can be proven to be resilient in the face of a storm. And we do know that rebuilding back when it is feasible, when it is an option, is sometimes a great option. I mean, you just have to look here in California. Most of the state is impacted by earthquakes, but you don't see people moving away necessarily. You see building codes that have changed. The 1994 Northridge earthquake changed the way we understood how to build. Right. And that's similar to what we're seeing with storms and disasters, environmental disasters. We're seeing communities that are reimagining their building codes to help people find sustainable, safe ways to rebuild in their communities and to make those communities more resilient. And more that does need to be an option, because the reality is we are running out of space to move into, especially with a growing population, with a lack of affordable housing. We need to reimagine the ways that we have impacted our habitats, and we need to restore our habitats to make them more resilient, much like the scientists on Lahaina had encouraged. And unfortunately, action wasn't taken until it was too late for communities that have not been impacted yet. And a growing number of communities are threatened by climate change. A new study out last month showed nearly half of all American homes are threatened by climate change. This is the time to identify threats and to build resilient communities, so you're not faced with the decision, do I stay or do I go?
Right.
Yeah, and speaking of looking to nature, now, of course, here in Utah, we do deal with wildfire risk, and we have been working on wildfire mitigation, but you actually were out here in our own backyard in Colville. Can you tell us about that and how you were looking to nature and beavers in particular to help with this?
Beavers are a wonderful species. They are called a keystone species because they have this ability to build wetlands that support an incredible number of species, and also us. They support us and protect us. And this was discovered not by me, but by a researcher in California who, after a wildfire, identified an area of lush vegetation, a huge strip, we're talking about 20 acres, that did not go up in flames. Everything around it had burned to the ground, except for this small ecosystem. And what she found at the center of it all was a beaver dam. So beavers, they act as speed bumps when they build their dams. The water still filters through, but it slows it down so that the aquifer and the ground can absorb that water and give birth to lush vegetation that can withstand wildfire. After this discovery, there was this explosion in appreciation for beavers, because for so long, beavers were first treated as a commodity. They were hunted to near extinction in the early 1900s for their fur. And then they were treated as a nuisance because they caused a lot of flooding. But as drought has become pervasive in the West, suddenly landowners realized the benefit of having beavers on their land, and really at zero cost. And so after this research, and with this newfound appreciation and fear of fire, we started to see, as a nation, a new appreciation for the beaver. And in Colville specifically, we went to one rancher's land, a rancher who had eradicated beavers decades earlier from the land, who wanted them back. And I joined one organization based out of Salt Lake City that played a role in reintroducing beavers. And the reason humans have to help out is because streams have become so thin with water that they make beavers very vulnerable to predators. So we went in with this group building beaver analog dams, which is just a fancy word for saying handmade, human-made beaver dams, so that we could reintroduce these beavers into that ecosystem. And sure enough, from last I understand, two beavers were introduced. We saw them as they made their new home there, and they're still thriving. And that area, as a result, has lush vegetation. And more landowners are recognizing the benefits of beavers as natural eco-engineers. And even in the state of California now, there's a new state program to introduce beavers to local communities to help make them more resilient in a very natural way. We're putting beavers to work. They're working at no cost, and they're helping protect us.
Absolutely. They just need to be rebranded.
Because they do.
Like you say, they've spent decades and decades or centuries as varmints, right? And pests and nuisances. And now we recognize them as great benefits to the ecosystems and to ourselves. We only have a couple more minutes. And of course, I'm going to ask you a question that will take 5 minutes to answer. But anyway, we interviewed Abram Lustgarten about his book, On the Move, last week or so. Mm-hmm. And then we talk about communities on the move, having to say we can't come back for one reason or another. But he also talked about what's interesting, that economies and businesses have to migrate too. And, you know, there'll be a point where you won't be able to grow cotton, let's say in Arizona, because it'll be too hot. So whole systems of business and economies may have to move to and migrate. Do you have a quick example of that?
Yeah, yes. And I do believe, and the researchers that I've spoken with stress that it is important, regardless of what community you live in, if there is an opportunity to rebuild back or to strengthen and make a community more resilient, that is the best option. Because being on the move is difficult for both those who are moving and for host communities that are receiving. Right. Oftentimes, and I'm not sure if this was part of your earlier discussion, there is a friction and a tension that comes when you have new people moving into new places, not always being welcomed by those host communities. Right. In Chico, California, which is just a 20-minute drive from Paradise, you saw their population spike 20,000 just in a period of a few years after the fire. And today you have conflict from those that live and have called Chico home, voters who are coming out against affordable housing. So we're starting to see, and I've seen that firsthand in Chico and in Paradise, this conflict that emerges when people are on the move. And this is very similar to what happened back in 2006 following Hurricane Katrina, when you had more than a million migrants, climate migrants, that were dispersed across the country and weren't always welcomed by their host communities. Georgetown University finding that some communities became less supportive of funding for programs for the poor and for African Americans. And I believe that this is a critical fault line for our nation and other countries to pay attention to, because while moving is in some cases the best option, it does prevent a host of other conflicts for both communities that are host communities and those people who have lost their communities and are looking to start over again.
Well, the name of the book is Before It's Gone: Stories from the Front Lines of Climate Change in Small Town America. The author is Jonathan Vigliotti. Real quick, Jonathan, website people can go to learn more about your work and this book?
Yeah, I'm on Instagram at Jonathan Vigliotti, and I do have a website that's not as updated, jonathanvigliotti.com.
All right, perfect. And let's have you back, because obviously this story is just beginning.
I would love to.
And ongoing. We'll stay in touch. Jonathan, thank you so much for joining us this morning on This Green Earth.
Thank you.
Thank you for having me.